This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Valkovsky, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And good morning. I'm Steve Brown, welcoming you into this edition of Education Matters here on WGTDHD. I'm very pleased to welcome as my two guests, Professor Dan Weddle, who's professor of law at the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Law, and also Professor Catherine Ross. And Professor Ross is the Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. I want to welcome both of you to Education Matters.
Great to be here, Steve.
Yeah, thank you.
Our topic today will cover a number of areas. We're going to talk about censorship, First Amendment rights, things related directly to that, and also Professor Weddle and I will be talking with Professor Catherine Ross also about her book, a 2015 book, Lessons in Censorship, How Schools and Courts Subvert Students' First Amendment Rights. First of all, let me ask you this, Professor Ross, and I'll call you Catherine now, if that's okay.
Please.
Oh, okay, very good. I know you wrote your book back in 2015, and I was aware of it when it came out. I actually used portions of it in my school law classes that I taught at several universities. As you look at where things are today in 2022, and when you look back at all the research, all the work you did in your book that was published in 2015, what are two or three major changes you see right now that were not in place or were not occurring at the time you wrote your book?
The changes are more in scale than in actual events. But there have been a few really disturbing things, particularly in the last half year or less. In particular, we have to think both about the curriculum, which has one set of First Amendment rules, and then about school libraries, which are supposed to be a place for independent inquiry. And let me start with the curriculum. My book, Lessons in Censorship, focuses on the major Supreme Court cases that set out the scope of student rights in public schools from kindergarten through 12th grade. And public schools include, by the way, charter schools. They are public schools, so they are required to follow the commands of the speech clause. And in schools, students do have First Amendment rights, but they are slightly different from the rights that all of us have outside the walls of the school when we're talking about government regulation generally. So in the major case, the first case of modern school speech, Tinker versus Des Moines, the court said very clearly that the classroom is the quintessential place for exploring ideas. And it is absolutely a place for diverging viewpoints and controversy that can be promoted by the students and, I should say, by the teachers. Mm-hmm. Over the course of the next 50 years or more, both of those rights have been squashed a bit, not eliminated, but tamped down. And in particular, the scope of teachers' rights to introduce new material has been limited because of developments in what we call public employee speech, and teachers are public employees. So that has meant that what the school puts forth in its curriculum is often seen to limit the teacher, and the teachers have a harder time bringing in supplementary materials that they have chosen. So one of the things that's been going on in this last year is a virulent effort all over the country to suppress what is included in the standard curriculum, particularly with attacks in many, many states on the ability to teach theories about race or parts of American history that make some people, and really this is the word they use, uncomfortable. So that's one part of it, the curricular attacks. Now the library, which even more than a classroom, has traditionally been understood to be a place for exploration. It's where students can go to learn things that they're not being offered in the curriculum or at home. And the at-home part is at the crux of the issue. For many decades, organized groups have tried to get certain kinds of books they regard as controversial for political, partisan, or moral reasons removed from libraries. And the pace of those challenges to library books has geometrically multiplied just in the last few months. The ACLU, which has tracked this for a long time, says they've never seen this many challenges. The American Library Association never saw so many challenges. And one of the, and certainly there were challenges to library books when I wrote Lessons in Censorship, and there were challenges to curricular discussions and teachers who got in trouble for saying things the school board didn't like. But both of those are just so much part of the public agenda now and so much in the news. And let me just say a couple of things about libraries. Unfortunately, while the Supreme Court considered a case about the political removal or the potentially political removal of library books in 1982 from a school district in Long Island, New York, Island Trees, they didn't have a majority holding. So we have a plurality opinion that left a lot of unsettled questions, but basically said, if you want to remove books from a library, you can do so for educational suitability, which isn't a very clear standard, but you cannot do it in order to discriminate based on viewpoint. And that is not binding because it was not a majority decision. So we don't actually have Supreme Court protection when people challenge library books for political reasons. And we have this year wholesale removal. You know, one legislator in Texas did a list of 850 books and said, just remove them. And we have pictures on television of people just boxing up books and librarians saying they're afraid to acquire books that might be seen as controversial. So both of those are very big changes in the level of the problem and the public focus on the problem.
Dan Weddle, I know you want, and I can't see you, I can only hear you. You sent me a link, I believe it was from the Fifth Circuit, on a whole bunch of books, I think very similar to what Catherine's talking about.
Well, and some of these books are award-winning books, and the justifications, they tend to be targeting books that discuss racism or LGBTQ issues, and they, you know, and sometimes they'll say, well, it's got graphic pictures or graphic descriptions of sex, and having not read these, since I don't read children's books much, I don't know what they mean by graphic. But, you know, there's some really interesting, for example, a parent asked administrators at the Spring Branch Independent School District in Houston to pull a graphic novel which features gay and bisexual characters because she claimed it might lead young students to, quote, question their sexual orientation when they don't even comprehend what that means. Another one, this happened in a Dallas suburb called Prosper, which touches on racism that Olympian Wilma Rudolph experienced growing up in Tennessee should be removed from school libraries because, quote, it opines prejudice based on race. most of these most of the objections to this list of books sound like that.
Catherine, when you hear this and when you know what Dan, of course, is obviously talking about, is this happening in other parts of the country that are not that would not be typically viewed as conservative parts of our country?
Yes, it's happening really all over the country in local school districts, in part because this is part of a national movement. And there are a couple of groups that have been promoting it that provide scripts, that provide lists of books. Mm-hmm. One is called Moms for Liberty. They're very well funded. There have been reporters who have followed some of these meetings and who say that the same people are showing up at some of them. So they're obviously not just local parents. And yes, I think we're not as aware of what's going on at the really local level as opposed to the statewide level, in part because we have so few local newspapers now. Mm-hmm. But we are definitely seeing that. And I wanted to mention, it's not just books that involve gender identity questioning or nonconformity. It's really all books that mention sex, because a lot of parents, the same parents who don't want their kids to get sex education in school, don't want them to read books with that kind of information.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when we think about speech rights, we're usually thinking about the right to form and articulate your views. But forming views also involves the ability to get information. So part of speech rights is what we call the right to receive information. And that is also a First Amendment right. So there isn't a right to receive specific or diverse information in a classroom, but the library is where students are supposed to be able to go to supplement
mm-hmm.
the information and viewpoints they're being given in class. And that is one of the things that makes these book removals so pernicious and gives them so much potential to undermine our civic democracy by depriving people of a wide range of viewpoints. And the book removals have gone beyond book removals. Just last week, there was a huge book burning just outside Nashville, Tennessee.
So let me ask you first, Dan Weddle, if you had the opportunity to speak to a school board association, regardless of where it might be, in Kansas where you live, or Missouri, or here in Wisconsin, or in New York, or in Washington, D.C., what kinds of things, Dan, would you talk about?
Well, the first thing I would explain is that the right to hear or receive information is as powerful as the right to speak or disseminate information. That's part of the First Amendment right. And so when we block that for students, we have to be able to justify it under the Tinker standard that we're not doing it just out of an undifferentiated fear that it might cause some sort of disruption to the mission of the high school. One of my favorite quotes of all time comes out of West Virginia Board of Education v. Barnett,
mm-hmm.
where a couple of young students were suspended because they were Jehovah's Witnesses and refused to recite the Pledge of Allegiance or salute the flag, which at that time was common. And the court said, if there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion. If there are any circumstances which permit an exception, they do not now occur to us. That was in 1943, at the height of World War II, the height of push for patriotism, and the court said, you cannot compel these students to speak that way. I think that exact same concept applies to preventing them from hearing educationally appropriate viewpoints that some parents may disagree with.
Catherine, a follow-up the same question for you.
Dan covered a lot of ground, but there are a few things I'd like to add. The same case he's talking about the Jehovah's Witness sisters, mm-hmm. who were actually in elementary school.
Right.
And the court also said that not only do the protections of the Bill of Rights apply in schools, but that there is no place more important for teaching those, for applying and teaching those principles than our schools. And therefore, the courts may not just defer to boards of education, much as the justices did not want to spend their time running the school system.
Mm-hmm.
And that principle remains true today. And in a lot of these cases, the people calling for getting books out of libraries and out of the curriculum are very clear about their motives. They are not being careful to tailor what they say publicly. So this Representative Krause in Texas, who made a list of 850 books he wanted removed from every school library, said he had identified the books that might make students feel discomfort, which is exactly the same rationale that many state legislatures are using when they're trying to prevent the teaching of the history of slavery or racial discord or voter suppression.
Mm-hmm.
Discomfort, it's very clear, and every single Supreme Court case about student speech rights, whether to speak up or to hear, has said you cannot censor speech to avoid controversy or to avoid discomfort. You need a lot more than that, and there are various standards they've set out. I think it's also important to note that this has become a magnet for adult political disagreement. I think everybody listening has already figured that out.
Hmm.
But one of the issues is who gets to decide. So back in 2015, from my reading of every reported case about school speech rights and many cases that never made it to court, I pointed out that the classic pattern is that one student complains at home or says something at home that didn't even bother the student, and a parent gets angry and confronts the principal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how most of these controversies start about any kind of student speech. And the same is true when we talk about books and their choice and removal. So that parent confronts the principal. The principal thinks, I don't need a big controversy. The school board doesn't need that. So they try to placate the parent. And the next thing they know, they're in boiling water over First Amendment rights violations and very costly litigation to the school district. And the same thing appears to be going on here. So the question is, if there are parents who don't want their kids receiving certain kinds of information, and let's try to limit this to the library, which is optional, rather than to required courses, because I think they should be treated differently. But could the parents get to say, just don't let my kid check this book out?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they get to say, nobody's children?
Yeah.
Can get access, and other parents might not only not care, but might affirmatively want their children to have access. And this is even more complicated as local budgets have been decimated in the last decade. And in many, particularly rural districts, there isn't a public library, or there isn't transportation to get to a public library. So the school library may be actually the community library, or certainly the only library that students have access to.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. By the way, both of you talking about the Barnett case, I thought it was fascinating, and Catherine, you pointed out in your book that when Justice Jackson read the opinion aloud, and by the way, he had been the former Attorney General for President Roosevelt. He read the court's decision aloud from the bench, and he did so on Flag Day, a day on which teachers and patriotic groups focus on the flag's meaning. And when I read that portion of your book, Catherine, the first thing that came into my mind is, I don't care what the topic is, who is discussing it, why they are discussing it, but when it comes down to it, everything is political, correct?
Yes. Sadly, yeah. Everything is political.
Yeah.
I also just mentioned that Justice Jackson, that is one of the most beautifully written opinions mm-hmm. about the meaning of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And as Dan said, written during the Second World War. But he really tackles what makes the United States different from totalitarian regimes of any political viewpoint.
Right.
And he does so in very strong language that I think would be very well worth people's while to reread today. And he then took a leave from the bench because he was the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials.
That's right. Fascinating. I mean, just his historical presence and involvement, which is seldom talked about, is quite remarkable. Dan, you were going to make a comment?
Well, if you haven't heard of this, I'm going to make both of you and all your audience insane. There was a bill introduced a week or so ago in the Oklahoma State Legislature called the Students' Religious Belief Protection Act. And here's what it provides. Teachers can be fined a minimum of $10,000 per incident per individual, and people can sue teachers. This is, I think, based on the Texas abortion approach.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
They can be fined $10,000 per incident per individual. The fines have to be paid from their personal resources, and if they can't pay the fine, they have to be fired. It would also allow parents to demand removal any books perceived as anti-religious. This includes topics like evolution, the Big Bang Theory, and even birth control. And the definition of deeply held beliefs is not defined. And of course, the courts tend to avoid determining whether beliefs are deeply held, because they don't want to be in the business of judging people's religious beliefs. So if that gets passed and becomes law, I think a couple of things are going to happen. Curricula are going to be wildly pared back, and I think they're going to be facing a much worse teacher shortage in Oklahoma
mm-hmm.
than all the states are facing now, because Who's going to get up and teach something that's going to subject them to a $10,000 fine per incident and being fired? So this is a muzzling of teachers. It is a muzzling of students' ability to think about information that's important to know. It's a very dangerous development, I think, in our republic, and if it doesn't stop, if the courts don't put a stop to it, if members of the school community don't put a stop to it, we're gonna be in a very dangerous and dark place that we've never been in before.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree with Dan. This is one of the most extreme proposals that we have really ever seen. And it will definitely strangle speech and critical thinking, and it will cripple a generation of students who will not be prepared for higher education or careers in science, et cetera, even leaving aside these civic concerns. I'm assuming people who listen to this show, Education Matters, really care about these issues. And one of the problems that I think we're facing is that the people who would like to limit speech and limit the kinds of or the range of ideas that public school students are exposed to are very organized and very active. And I think a lot of other parents and citizens just assume, you know, things are fine in my community. But right now we're in a period where it behooves everybody who cares about these issues to show up at school board meetings,
mm-hmm.
to pay attention, to who is on the school board, what is going on in those local elections, and maybe even consider running for the school board.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. In the years that I taught school administration to teachers who wanted to become principals or superintendents, and I was teaching at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago, the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, along with a few universities in Texas, is that I would always say exactly what you just said, Catherine, and that is, if you live where you're not teaching, meaning in your school district, you know, consider running for the school board. I'm running unopposed this year, as is another incumbent, and of course there are many school districts here in Wisconsin. There are many school districts here in Wisconsin where there were attempts to recall some board members. So you're absolutely right. I wanted to sort of change the pace a bit. We talked also.
Before we do, Steve, I just want to say thank you for walking the walk and not
okay.
just talking the talk.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. You know, we've talked about the Tinker v. Des Moines case, and John Tinker has been a guest on Education Matters before. In fact, John was a guest along with Ken Starr and Howard Bolting, who was at the time my department chair at Northeastern Illinois University. But as we look at the Tinker case, black armbands, the court rules in favor of the students 7-2. But then other cases after that, Hazelwood, Bong Hits for Jesus, and then also Bethel v. Frazier, all these cases that we've talked about before. And then, of course, most recently, the Brandy Levy case, B.L. versus Mahonoy, and the court ruled in favor of her. As you look at those cases, and I'll pose this first with you, Catherine, as you look at all those cases and where we are today and everything that both of you have been saying, how important are those court decisions, and are those going to be overturned at some point, meaning that the Tinker v. Des Moines case has said that unless there's a material and substantial disruption, and I know there are two prongs to that case that you talk about, Catherine, as do you, Dan, but where do you see things going as far as these cases that will end up in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I am not optimistic given the current court. So first of all, Tinker is still the first standard that applies to student speech unless the school can convince the court that some other category of speech is involved. Mm-hmm. So Tinker is the general rule for student speech on campus. And as you said, it requires that the school have some evidence, a reasonable anticipation that the speech will cause material disruption to the school,
mm-hmm.
or the second prong is interfere with the rights of others. But when you, first of all, very few cases use that. As Justice Brennan pointed out, it has to be some legal right of others, not the right not to feel uncomfortable. And when you really look at those cases, they really involve rights of others that are associated with or are impeded because of material disruption. They really blend together as used. But then you've got, you know, is the speech school sponsored, which is mm-hmm. the Kathy Kallmeyer standard, in which case the school has enormous discretion. And part of what I was saying about the lack of a wide marketplace of ideas in classrooms is the interpretation that Hazelwood actually applies to classroom speech, mm. which did not appear to be the original intent of the case. Then, you know, lewd speech can be disciplined, and speech about promoting illegal substances, even though unless they're political. But let's look at the current court, because the most recent case, Mahonoy, which, as you said, was the first time since Tinker that a student prevailed,
mm-hmm.
but it is a very limited ruling, even though the press celebrated it
sure.
as a big victory for students' rights. They were wrong. And the reason they were wrong is that in this case, what the student said would have been protected speech, even in school. It did not violate the Tinker standard, It was not school-sponsored. Tinker applied, and everyone agreed, including the school.
Yeah, by the way, without using the four-letter word that Brandy Levy used, I described very, very briefly what Brandy did and the platform she used, and just so,
sure,
in case our audience may not know.
Oh, okay. So Brandy was a frustrated cheerleader. She didn't make it onto varsity after her first year on junior, and she had some other setbacks in her life, and she and a friend on a Saturday afternoon, clearly not even the school week, were at a convenience store, and using her phone, they went on, and they went on a disappearing platform. I think it was Snapchat.
Yes,
so
yes.
It was just going to be up very briefly. I'm an old person. I don't always get this right. They showed a certain controversial finger.
Right. I believe it was the middle finger sticking up, right?
Yep, okay. The middle finger. They used a word starting with F and ending with K. F cheerleading, F this, F that, F the other thing. And a member of the team saw it. Her mother was a coach, and she got in trouble at school. And the school never even said they thought it would lead to disruption. So that should have been the end of the case. But instead, the court used the case to talk about to what extent schools might be able to punish students for what they say off campus. They said they couldn't even define what off campus was in the modern world.
Mm.
They couldn't decide what level of protection students would have for their off-campus speech. Would it be the Tinker material disruption standard? Would it be a standard easier for the schools to satisfy? They left all of the important questions unresolved.
Mm-hmm. By the way, as you're saying that, I'm sorry to interrupt.
But
Bong Hits for Jesus, Joe Frederick, Juneau, Alaska, in 2006 or 7, the Olympic flags being marched through, and they're off campus, and he holds up a banner.
Right.
So as you were saying that, the Tinker standard didn't come into it. It was talked about enormously in the Brandy Levy case between the federal district court and the U.S. Supreme Court, like close to 100 times Tinker is mentioned, but what kind of comparison do you draw between what Brandy Levy did and what Joe Frederick did?
Okay, so that's a great question. Let me, before I get to that, just say one last thing,
sure,
about Mahanoy, because I think Mahanoy opens the door by not giving us answers for school districts and principals to say, let me push this boundary, right? Let me see how far I can go off campus, because they haven't told me. So I think it's actually a dangerous case.
Hmm.
But now, comparing those two off-campus speech cases, you're right that the students in the Bong Hits for Jesus case were across the street outside of school. But it was a school activity, because
right,
the principal had said, let everybody go out and watch the Olympic relay. It's so exciting. It's going on right here. There were teachers there supervising them. And so the decisive vote that gave a majority to that decision by the Chief Justice says, this is the furthest boundary of the ability to supervise off-campus speech. Whatever the full definition is, this is on the side of the line that allows the school to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
In effect,
that looks very different from Brandy Levy on a Saturday afternoon, not involved in an extracurricular activity that day in a convenience school store. If anyone is in charge, it's her parents. And the last thing I'll say about Joe is, he actually came late to school and had never checked
in. That's right.
And he was 18 years old, which to me should make a difference.
You know, in effect, what happened in that case, in the Bong Hits case, is that the school event came to him. And that's why his arguments that he wasn't at school failed. And I'll tell you that the administrators I've spoken to do not want worldwide jurisdiction over internet speech. They don't need that. They have enough headaches just running to school, having to then worry about whether there's some duty on their part to intervene because some kid got on the internet at home and said something that then ends up at the school because of the internet being uncontrollable. They don't really want it. Most administrators don't want those headaches on their desk.
I agree with that, and it's the same thing with, almost every state has made schools in theory responsible for off-campus bullying. Mm-hmm.
Right.
We have given our schools so much responsibility, and we expect so much of them, and, the wisest school administrators understand that they need to narrow their focus and do what they're doing as well as they can.
Mm-hmm. You know, right. By the way, in the Bonghits decision, Clarence Thomas, and you pointed out so exactly, Catherine, in your book, only Justice Thomas used the opportunity in Morse to present his own thoughts about education, and they were not encouraging to advocates for student rights, that he wrote separately only for himself to say that children have no rights in schools. And that is so seldom talked about in the Morse v. Frederick Bonghits for Jesus case. Why is that? Why is it that no one talks about those comments?
I think partly because he got no takers on the entire court for that notion. In fact, the one encouraging thing I thought about the Randy Levy case was that Pinker was reaffirmed repeatedly.
Yes.
And so because there's been a long-term fear that Pinker was being chipped away at, and I don't think Justice Thomas has been able to convince anybody on the court.
Sure.
That Pinker ought to be overruled, although he said he would do it at the first opportunity. And it cuts again, as all of this does, to what we're trying to accomplish in public education, what motivated the original common school movement that became public education, and that was prepare students for citizenship in the real world where there are disputes, there are controversies, and if they're not ready for that, they're not ready to be citizens, to behave as citizens in our republic in any responsible way. I'll make one last point, and that is these people who are pushing for these kinds of oppressions on speech are forgetting it's a double-edged sword. Just because it's not coming from the left right now doesn't mean it won't come.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're going to suddenly find uprisings that then are going to so gut the curriculum that there is no public school education in any substance. It'll just be this milquetoast elementary education, and that's what our schools are going to become.
Mm-hmm. Let me say this. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, as we wrap things up, because our time is very short, Catherine. As you think about everything we have talked about today, all the work that you do, the articles you write, and I've looked at all the things that you have published online over the last couple of years, give us a 30-second take on where we are right now and where we're going to be in say, 6 months.
Well, 6 months might not be quite long enough for everything to play out.
Okay.
I think Thomas may get some more takers on this newly reconfigured court when we get a different kind of case. Several of the justices have been talking a lot about the in loco parentis doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
In school, that parents have really turned their kids over to the schools, which does not hold up on analysis.
Right.
But it would very much support the parents who are going in there and saying, don't teach these subjects, don't let my kids have access to these books and these ideas. That is very scary. I agree with Dan that we could strip down the public schools to nothing more than the three R's.
Mm-hmm.
And going a little beyond my expertise, that means we will not be economically competitive. We will not be able to have a healthy democracy. One of the themes motivating lessons in censorship. This is where 90% of American kids are in public schools, and this is where they learn to be citizens, to exercise their rights, think about and participate in democracy. So the risks that we are facing right now are quite profound, and people need to really pay attention to them.
And Dan Weddle, the same question for you.
Well, I think that if we're stripped down to the three R's, we're going to lose two of them, reading and writing. And so about all that's going to be left is arithmetic. It's hard to get upset that 2 + 2 = 4. And we're going to get down to where that's the only thing that can be taught. So this trend has got to stop, or we are not going to prepare the next generation for citizenship. And that was the whole point of public schools.
Sure.
So we've got some extremists who want to run the entire country from their extreme positions, and this nation has got to stand up to it and say no.
Okay, very good. I want to really thank both of you, Professor Catherine Ross, who is professor of law at George Washington University Law School, and thank you, Catherine, for all of your incredible work. And I've enjoyed working with you and things that we've done with the Tinker Foundation, and people can go onto your website at the university, and particularly your publications. Also, I want to thank Professor Dan Weddle, professor of law at the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Law. And we covered a lot of material, and we could probably go on for another hour, and we'll schedule something else in the future. Again, thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Steve and Dan. This was a great conversation.
Yes, it was.
For Education Matters Today, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. You're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
And a very pleasant good morning, and welcome to the WGTD Radio Theater. This morning we present the Cedar Chest Letters, and we're broadcasting live from the Racine, Wisconsin campus of Gateway Technical College. When Racine resident and longtime member of the 91.1 Players, Barbara Tyla, found a packet of old letters in her mother's cedar chest, she knew she had something special. In telling her family story, Barb offers a view of our shared heritage. Despite the challenges of the Great Depression and the early days of World War II, love conquers all in this charming play based on the letters her family left behind. The Cedar Chest Letters was written by Barb Tyla and stars members of the award-winning 91.1 Players. Support for the WGTD Radio Theater comes from the Kenosha Law Firm of Aaliyah, Dumay, and McTernan. Also supporting the WGTD Radio Theater is the not-for-profit Brown Ostrup Performing Arts Foundation, located in Salem, Wisconsin. And now, the Cedar Chest Letters.
Good morning. You know what a cedar chest is, don't you? Hope chest, they used to call them. My parents had one. I believe Mom kept her blankets in it and sweaters. Just ordinary things. Nothing special. Nothing of value until one day after her death I opened it. There were over 60 letters in that box, all addressed to my mother. They ran from 1932 to 1943.